Chapter 13. And the solution? In Switzerland, the referendum has given good proof of its worth and could perhaps show us the way to obtain better government. Vilfredo Pareto. The people's veto. The hybrid democracy. Vilfredo was onto something when he noted that the Swiss were making good use of the referendum. He didn't cotton on to its being the sword of Damocles hanging over the head of the elites he was so fond of studying, but that is what it is. However, one man who did see it for what it is was the previously mentioned A.V. Dicey. So, let's remind ourselves what our great constitutionalists said about the referendum, that it is the only check on the predominance of party, which is at the same time democratic and conservative. If he says this about it, it seems to me that we can implement what I propose with some urgency. Not only that, it is the marker that signals that we are becoming a real democracy, one in which the people have the power. After all, it is the only check on the predominance of party. I'll repeat that, the only check. Dicey's claim, not mine. So if any of you have a better idea, I look forward to hearing from you. Now, back to the Swiss example with the referendum as the cornerstone of our upgraded hybrid democracy. I sometimes hear people talking about the Swiss as if they are a different breed, a Homo Swissicus, not like the rest of us. But they are like us, very much so. They have history, too. As I mentioned when referring to Thomas More's Utopia, he wanted the fictionalized people he had based upon the Swiss eviscerated, eradicated, exterminated. When he wrote his fable, the warlike hillmen were the bane of Europe, supplying capable mercenaries to the highest bidder. In the centuries that followed, Switzerland remained fractious. It was not some peasant's paradise. The elites in the cantons gripped their small fiefdoms in their mailed fists. No velvet glove for this lot. Unlike the cannier central banking crew today. To show you how prevalent revolts were, and all the below were crushed, have a look at the period from 1650 to 1790. 1653, the peasants of the Emmental and Entlebuch against their rulers. 1717 to 1729, the revolt of Wilchingen against Schaffhausen. 1719 to 1722, the revolt of Württemberg against Glarus. 1723, the revolt of Vaud against Bern. 1726 to 1739, the revolt of Jura peasants against the Prince-Bishop of Basel. 1755. The revolt of the Leventina against Uri. 1781. The revolt of Chenaux against Fribourg. As Europe's premier supplier of mercenary fighting forces, a Swiss guard was employed by Louis XVI, the king beheaded by the French revolutionaries. When tens of thousands of the revolting French descended upon his palace, Louis asked his Swiss mercenaries to lay down their arms. But, loyal to their code, they refused, and hundreds died in the ensuing fight. The Swiss now only supply the Pope with his Vatican Guard, where revolt is not expected soon. So the Swiss hardly occupied a heavenly state, sipping milk and chomping chocolate. But within a few generations of the last revolt, they achieved something unique, though. In 1847, Friedrich Engels had gone so far as to dismiss the Swiss, referring to their earlier battles not as manifestations of liberty, but desperate acts of brutal and bigoted mountaineers who resisted civilization and progress. A year later, he and his co-author published The Communist Manifesto. Whilst the Swiss adopted their new 1848 constitution, enshrining the right of the people to have a say in revisions to the constitution. Well, Friedrich, your murder mag has served as the infamous handbook of mass-killing communists around the globe, and unfortunately is still read and adhered to by Chinese genocidaires and North Korean rocketeers. It seems to me that the bigots in the hills knocked out a realistic plan, whilst you and your bearded sponger mate gave us the blueprint for the most blood-soaked utopias ever foisted upon mankind. In my view, and Britain's leading constitutional expert, it seems, the mountaineers took the only path out of the mess that we are in, trapped in our own tottering representative democracies. So, we must take the well-maintained and clearly marked route to a similar hybrid democratic solution if we are to reach our own sunlit uplands. And as Dicey made clear, this is how we subordinate the parties, through the right of the people to call for a referendum on a law they object to. It's not perfect, just a lot damned better than any alternative, and it's been tried, tested, and tweaked over 7 generations. Never forget, the Bolshe Swiss had been split on many levels, with proud cantons with different religions, a mix of languages, and clashing class interests. Nonetheless, they rose above these. They engaged their brains and decided to come together, to be tolerant, reasonable, and humble, and to listen to and to understand the views of others. We can do this too when we have the referendum in our hands. The crux of their 1848 constitution was that it facilitated the adaptation to changing times. Article 3 proclaimed that the federal constitution can be revised at any time. Such a revision demanded the approval of the majority of the cantons and of the population. For the first time, a modern nation adopted a national referendum of its people as a central plank of its routine operation as a democracy. In the decades ahead, this great innovation would be added to as more and more elements of direct democracy were added, tried, and improved upon, thankfully. Today, if they gain over 50% of the vote in a referendum, they win, and any draft law proposed by the Parliament goes in the bin or back for revision. Switzerland also offers its people the opportunity to present their own initiatives to the nation, which can be implemented as laws if the proposition gains enough signatures in support to justify a national referendum, with the law implemented if they gain over 50% of the referendum's vote. So, these are the basic elements of their direct democracy. They are not complicated, but they also put a sensible hurdle in the way of a referendum, so that votes on essentially trivial issues are not imposed on the electorate. They need to collect 50,000 signatures to earn a national referendum on any new law punched out by the politicians in the legislature. The fact that such a referendum may be held also helps focus the minds of the party operatives, as they have to ensure that the law is likely to be acceptable to a majority of voters before they issue it. How many laws do you think would be struck down by our people today if we had such a system? And how about proposing your own law and seeing it pass? You need 100,000 signatures to see a national referendum held on your initiative, but at least you can have a go. In the UK, if we were to mirror this process, we would probably need to set the hurdles at around 400,000 signatures for the referendum on a law and about 800,000 for the initiative, as these are roughly proportional with the Swiss figures. They have a population of 8.8 million. However, that will be up to you, the voters, to decide, not me, not some party, nor some clique of elites. It will be our decision. There are other differences in the Swiss parliamentary system to ours, but I will not be detailing these because the fulcrum on which the system pivots is the referendum, the people's veto, Dicey's decider. A simple and well-illustrated 90-odd page booklet on how the country's system works is Swiss Democracy in a Nutshell by Vincent Kuchel and Mix and Remix. A great investment, I reckon. Forget all the slogans and bull issued by the parties. If they don't support Dicey's democratic equalizer, you can ask what it is about the people having a say in the laws inflicted on us that they don't like. Any decent politician will support the veto, only Rumuns won't, and these are the ones you want to vote out. I will cite Hans Kohn again. the founder of the study of nationalism, of which he was very wary and why he looked so closely at Switzerland. He found that its remarkable success as a democracy was due, above all, to the spirit of tolerance, restraint, and goodwill to minorities. These sound like the qualities which many people would like to ascribe to themselves today, and it is this that makes this formerly warlike, multilingual nation an example for continental Europe. A proven success in 1956 when Cohn published his book, but ignored by the European politicians who later established the organization that is now the EU. However, maybe the Europeans were reluctant because the Yankee money boys pushed for a united Europe as it suited their globalist objectives in the grand area idea. Control of the resources, a bigger market, and pocketed politicians. Nothing sexist here when I talk of the money. Boys, it is Sandra Navidi who notes in a chapter in Superhubs, Womanomics, The Missing Link, that. You may wonder why so far I have written almost exclusively about men. The reason is that, regrettably, women are largely absent from the top level of finance, as homophily dominates and heterophily, or diversity, only exists at rudimentary levels. With the melting away of the Iron Curtain, the resource area desired, and apparently now required by America's corporate hitmen, has gone global. As the Pentagon made clear back in 1996, their right to access whatever they want is enshrined in their minds and their doctrine. It seems that Russia, famous for its resources but not its resourcefulness, may be a lucrative target that some believe should be under the control of the planet's major owner, the asset management folk directing the pliant front they fund, the central banking elite. This is the real meaning of globalization, the control of all assets by the internationalist monopolists, and the locals can go hang. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians may be sacrificed on the altar of the assets, but that's a price worth paying to get their hands on those Russian goodies, a bit like that lot in Pennsylvania back in Ben Franklin's day. We are not actually free, but the localist-loving Swiss have shown us how to twist the control dial one more notch in our direction to be so, and it's just one vote away. 1. The American asset hunters are not the only fans of globalism, putting airy-fairy policy before people. The communists were famously international socialists, whilst Hitler was a nationalist one, as the Nazi Party's name made clear, the NSDAP, or National Socialist German Workers' Party. These National Socialists are infamous for the Holocaust and other atrocities, and this naturally led decent people to look closely at those espousing nationalism. However, the Swiss are nationalists and have no such reputation, and are an example to all of us, said Mr. Cohn, on how nationalism can be a positive force. However, this is because power is devolved in an effective policy of localization and direct voter control. In fact, the internationalists, the globalist utopian dreamers on the left, have killed many more than the crushed and humiliated Nazis and fascists, of whom a few remnant organizations remain. And those Swiss nationalists have not invaded anyone for hundreds of years. However, Marx's ideological zombies and Antifa types still stalk the planet and point their fingers at the apparitions, the pathetic ghosts of the Nazis, as fascists are still useful to the left, as a boogeyman to unnerve the naive. Meantime, the failed globalist socialist utopians burrow away to plant their own Fabian-inspired memes, or to let loose violence-prone activists in support of their own power-grasping aims, hoping to suck the life from the healthy body politic they enjoy feasting upon. Mass murdering and unrepentant communists are still running China and spreading their bile and their social control fetish, using their penetration expertise to gather and direct international traitors and any other mugs they can pay or manipulate to further their own unachievable globalist aims. Can anyone see the Vietnamese welcoming back the Chinese, so that they can enjoy their neighbor's dystopian nirvana for another several hundred years of subjugation. Do you not think that the voters might prefer to try the hybrid system, maintaining their culture and control whilst building healthy and strong links with other such nations around the globe? I do. A famous Stalin apologist historian, Eric Hobsbawm, wrote Nations and Nationalism since 1780, and in the closing lines of the book, he captured the hope that he and his fellow Marxists felt. "The owl of Minerva, which brings wisdom," said Hegel, "flies out at dusk. It is a good sign that it is now circling round nations and nationalism." Another supposedly smart intellectual talking of wisdom after he had seen his dream empire collapse, a man who discounted the Falkland Islanders' freedom to choose under whose government they should live by dismissing the battle for their home as a crazy war over some South Atlantic bog and rough pasture. That's not how the people there might have seen it, mate, but internationalists like Hobsbawm don't care about what the people think. They love an idea. Globalists are supposedly anti-imperialists, yet they are the ones advocating pushing folks together who really don't get on. What about South Sudan and the Sudan? They only recently separated after decades of genocidal raids by Muslim Janjaweed militias on the infidels to the south. It is childish to suggest that such people can be forced into Kumbaya land. It is the referendum that best settles such disputes, but where these cannot be resolved by this balm, then you don't have a nation, let alone a global utopia. You have to have separate states. The Soviet Marxists, subjugating, controlling, and doing their best to exterminate fractious Central Asians and others, did not manage to get the various national groups to cohere, and the price was terrible. The Kazakhs alone lost over half their people between 1917 and 1932, courtesy of the scheming socialists. Not a lot is said by the left about these communist eradications of millions of people because they did not fit into the internationalists' dreamscape. Inevitably, the Bolsheviks would have to rescind their promises in the Decree of Rights of the Peoples of Russia, November 15, 1917, which guaranteed not just autonomy, but even the right of secession to nations that wanted it. But policies were transformed and government treated them differently according to Moscow's perceptions of their political reliability, while eliminating some of them in administrative and even genocidal actions. Today, many new nations have emerged following the utopian death cult's collapse. Sadly, lots of them now suffer from the shoddy goods they were sold by Western neoliberals. The solution does not lie in our representative system, but in the widespread adoption of a hybrid system adapted for local conditions, with the referendum weapon as the first one deposited in the arsenal of democracy. The Swiss have demonstrated what is achievable in a hybrid democracy, and they have given the lie to the need for a global government, off which the monopolist carpetbaggers can fill their boots. The Swiss hybrid solution is here now, not in the future, at some unknown and unknowable point in time. It can be taken off the shelf and tweaked for groups that have a civil society that accepts the ideas upon which it is based, which includes most semi-functioning representative democracies. Over the years and decades ahead, these happy nations will grow in number, their example demonstrating the efficacy of the idea to other peoples and nations, drawing them together whilst maintaining the cultural differences they enjoy. Diversity is our strength, is it not? As we are all too aware, many nations that have fractious relationships between groups within their borders will find that the hybrid reduces tensions and that people do prefer laughing together rather than lynching each other. As I will show later, even slash-and-burn groups that have lived on their nerves from time immemorial really embrace positive change and can form new relationships with their old adversaries. People naturally prefer to live in harmony rather than in constant tension, An afternoon in a raucous pub in Edinburgh when the English come to play rugby is a clear demonstration of this. However, the old divide and rule elites will hate this, so be warned. They will turn up the heat, trying to stir up divisions and roll out big lie campaigns as cover for the raids of the asset-stripping banksters. The WEF is obviously an elitist delight, a place to schmooze and network for that next great position, heading the UN, the EU, the WHO, you know how it goes. Now let's see where they meet. Davos in Switzerland? Why do rich people enjoy visiting the direct democracy of choice? Okay, there's not a lot of choice, but you get my drift. In 2014, a survey measuring people's confidence in their national government found that the Swiss led the way, with 75% having confidence in their government. What that really showed is that they had confidence in themselves, in each other, and in their hybrid system of direct and representative democracy. The global average score, though? Well, that was 42%, which was the UK's score too. That for the US was just 35%. The Swiss are almost always in the top five happy countries too. I think we can agree that in most terms by which we can measure a nation's contentment and political stability, the mob-ruled mountain types are doing better than the rest. These people took most of the cake in 1848, whilst the elites in Europe grabbed the slice they left, and only a few crumbs fell from the table for the people to fight over. Well, it's time to make more room at the top table and shuffle the oddballs, who actually like doing dirty politics, to one side, and bring in more community-minded types wanting to do their bit for the people. Below, I will be laying out some figures from simple internet searches which help prove my case. I call this evidence-based politics, something it seems to me that is in short supply. Before looking at the figures, we'll address the hoary old tale that Swiss prosperity is due to banking secrecy. In fact, Switzerland was richer per capita than the UK before World War I began, and long ago the Swiss had taken in almost half the French Huguenot Protestants escaping persecution, and these immigrants brought great expertise and entrepreneurialism with them, as they did for the UK. Before the banks were used to house the stolen assets of nasty dictators, the Swiss had already developed a reputation as innovators and industrialists. In 2009, the year when banking secrecy was abolished for foreigners, the banking sector represented 10.85% of the economy, and 11 years after the law change, the sector stood at 9.7% of GDP. So the banks are important, but hidden assets were obviously not as prevalent as the myth suggests. Locke's 2022. Here is a snapshot of Swiss success under the hybrid. Swiss national debt in 2022, 40.27% of GDP. UK national debt in 2022, 86.99% of GDP, more than twice that of the hybrid lot. The Legatum Institute, based in the UK, in 2017, found that Switzerland had the best government in the world. Per capita GDP in 2021 from World Bank data. Switzerland, $91,991. UK, $46,510. US, $70,248. Average disposable income in 2014 after all taxes had been paid, Switzerland, $6,301 per month. This is nearly double the amount of the next three highest countries. Australia, $3,780. Denmark, $3,269. United States, $3,258. In 2017, Switzerland topped the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Index for the ninth year in a row, narrowly ahead of the United States and Singapore. The WEF plotters not only recognize Switzerland's success in economic terms. In 2020, they placed Switzerland at the top of its global rankings in education terms and third overall in Schwab's Human Capital Report. The US lagged at 26th and the UK at 29th. Switzerland is fourth per capita for winning Nobel Prizes, beating both the UK at 10th and the US at 15th. The Swiss are fourth on the list of life expectancy behind Hong Kong, Japan, and Macau. The UK is 29th and the US is 46th. And those representative democracies, what did they do to protect their people from the threat of nuclear war? They built shelters for political, military, and infrastructure leaders, but the rest of us? Nothing. Get under the table and cover your ears. That gives you an idea about their mindset. What about the Swiss, those anarchic, rampaging mobs of mountaineers? Well, they built shelters sufficient to house the whole country. Yes, every child, woman, and man, over 8 million people, the only country on the planet to do so. Do you think that might have been because they control the nation? Am I getting through to you about the difference between them and us? Here, Asse Dirt in Switzerland, everyone is a precious human being, but more importantly, they have the power. The Swiss spend a lot on defense, schools, and services, yet they have more cash in their pockets and half our rate of debt. Hopefully, you are beginning to see why. The people have the power, not the foundation, finagling, warmongering few. This gets to the heart of the supposed argument about what makes democracies powerful, that the willing members of the democracy can beat the pants off anyone else. So, what about Vietnam, Somalia, Afghanistan? The West lost to non-democracies because the opposition believed. Our people did not believe because we were split and often questioned the need for such wars. Neocons, former leftists who still believed in government action to enforce democracy but joined the Republicans when the Democrats went too far left, love bringing peace using the barrel of a gun, but seem to have a problem doing so against those they aim to aid. We were split because we are kept in separate silos to ensure that the few can control us. In Switzerland, the people have their say, so they keep out of other people's business and do not produce grand area maps that show what resources they must grab from the current occupants. The Swiss negotiate with the resource owners, come up with a market price, and sign an agreement. Seems to work, and no one gets killed. No utopia is created, but what would a world with many Switzerlands be like? Maybe lots of foreigners now see us more clearly than we do ourselves, swaggering around the planet, undermining those whose goodies we cherish, and attacking if necessary. Dead on both sides, but a few get richer. Is that a good plan? A good strategy? Maybe the Swiss, the Taiwanese, and the Estonians are on to something. Einstein held a Swiss passport until he died and took 5 years to gain that citizenship, as they don't hand them out with the crisp packets when you land on the shores of Lake Geneva. What did the world's most famous scientists think of that nation compared to the US and other places he had lived? Einstein remained a Swiss citizen until his death in 1955 and maintained a lifelong love for the country. When he was an elderly man, living in the academic community of Princeton University, he wrote, "I love the Swiss because, by and large, they are more humane than the other people among whom I have lived." It is worth thinking about why Einstein thought so highly of the Swiss. These were the same people that Thomas More had thought should be exterminated, and who had fought among themselves right up to 1847. Yet within decades, they somehow morphed into the most humane people Einstein had encountered. This can probably be accounted for by a number of factors, but I would assess that a considerable part can be attributed to the new life that each individual finds in a society in which, at last, their views count equally. The philosopher, Alistair MacIntyre, emphasizes this intrinsic link between society and morality in A Short History of Ethics. In fact, of course, moral concepts change as social life changes. I deliberately do not write because social life changes, for this might suggest that social life is one thing, morality another, and that there is merely an external, contingent causal relationship between them, this is absolutely false. Moral concepts are embodied in and are partially constitutive of forms of social life. This view is also alluded to by the Briton Dickon Bewes, who settled in Switzerland and has written an engaging book on the country and his love for it, Swiss Watching, Inside the Land of Milk and Money. He suggests that the voter's direct input also explains why the place is so well managed. At community, cantonal, and national level, the referendum system works because it involves everyone. It forces the politicians to address the issues and engages the voters in the detail of the debate. Most Swiss people love nothing more than discussing whichever issue is coming up at the next referendum. The happy Mr. Bewes ends his review of life in the mountain nation on a hopeful note for all of us. There is no paradise on earth, but the land of milk and money comes close. That'll do for me. You may hear the pathetic objection that referendums are just mob rule. Well, give it to me in spades, please. It seems that the voting powerhouse in the land of cows and chocolates shows us something entirely different. Happier voters, better schooling, a superb economy feeding off the great education system, and disposable income to dream of. But it's all real, and it's only one vote away. If this is mob rule, then why are our politicians happy to have a mob vote them in? They only seem loath to us keeping a check on them, and the manifesto promises they make, but don't keep. And when was the last time you heard of a mob running riot and storming the banks in Basel, or putting the garrison to the sword in Geneva? The Swiss get a lot of media coverage on laws coming up in Parliament, so if they want a referendum on something, they will have enough time and material to consider before they even put their signature to an appeal for a referendum. Only if enough people are motivated to call for one will the law be subjected to a national or local vote, as they do this at the canton, and in some case at community level as well. Time is allowed for gathering signatures so there is no flash mob overnight revolt, with shops being looted and police cars set aflame. In the end, the people can stop or amend laws, and they do so peacefully, with time for reflection to make their own informed and logical choice. I kind of like that. Maybe it's just the fairness thing about it that appeals, and I am betting it appeals to a lot of you. I am sure you would agree too that it's easier to live with a law when the people have spoken, and not just having laws and regulations doled out by time-serving representatives willing to toe the party line, or in the future by an unelected WHO official, all famously incorruptible, of course. You may also hear that proportional representation will sort out the current system. It won't if we don't adopt the hybrid. All parties end up being captured by the people at the top, serving their own ends, that iron law of oligarchy I covered earlier. Proportional representation just polishes a turd, but it's still a turd. The system is the problem, and the people's veto the solution because it is decisive and clear. With our final stamp, laws become ours, we own them and support them whether we back them or not. Yes, we will lose some votes, but we had our say, we feel heard, and as any ex-partner can tell you, that would be a good thing. However, proportional representation has its supporters, so when we get to have the veto and can put forward propositions as part of our improved system, then advocates for it can make their appeal to the people. The Swiss use it, no doubt, because it more closely represents voter proportions than our system does. The same goes for term limits, something else that people might want. These ensure that the representatives don't get too comfortable and crony-prone, heading out with influencers and cozying up in a flash restaurant, whilst a smooth-talking psycho supplies wonderful reasons to support that planning approval they want to get through to the next stage. When automatically booting out representatives at the end of their term, you lose the experience that people have gained, but you also reduce corruption. So the choice, again, will be yours. Of course, then you may be concerned that the civil servants who permanently oversee the system become the power center. However, this can be kept in check because they still have to pass any new legislation under the beady eyes of the voters, not just the less experienced politicians. I say let the people decide what that the right balance is, but you are only going to do such things with the hybrid system. The legislative guardians of our liberties must eventually be watched over by all of us, and that's the secret to this system. No cliques, no elites, and no special interests have the final say. And that is why they hate it, why they omit talking about it, and why they disparage it if it is mentioned. They never freely and honestly admit their errors, as they would give an advantage to their opponents. However, if we mess up with a law, we all own it, and can then quickly address it and fix it. That's how the best groups deal with issues, because there's no I in team. The Taiwanese people have benefited from direct democracy since they bravely transitioned from military to civilian rule in the 1980s and 90s, and some Swiss believe that their laws concerning direct democracy are superior to their own. But that's good, no? This gives us more examples to study, to learn from, and to adopt or adapt. Just ask yourself, would you rather live in communist China or the free-thinking and globally important chip manufacturing nation with a per capita income over three times that of their communist neighbor, the one that intimidates the Taiwanese and every other democracy in the region? Search the internet, check the figures, and see for yourself why the people's veto is necessary. Otherwise, just keep watching the hybrid and direct democracy crews move effortlessly and inexorably ahead year after year, vote after vote. And if you want more evidence, keep your eyes on Estonia. How are they doing in comparison to Russia, their autocratic neighbor? Estonia is the leading digital democracy in the world, admired by Swiss voting experts for its innovative approach. Every Estonian is issued a digital ID at birth, and all government services are available online, including voting, just one click away. The system is proving so popular with the voters that the local government voting platform is expanding to cope with the demand. This indicates that people love to vote and get involved when they can see that they are listened to, can influence the community, and have a direct say in the laws that they must abide by. Digital voting is not a necessity for any democracy, but it is Estonia's choice. It does not have to be ours, as in the hybrid, we get to decide. They know that the next important political issue is theirs to control, and they can impose their will every time a law is proposed. Like Switzerland and Taiwan, direct democracy in Estonia is a great part of the hybrid solution, a crucial element that ensures their system works better than the rest. I will close this section by reminding you that it is under representative governments that our wonderful leaders got us into the family spat we call World War I, the Great Depression, which the money-manufacturing private banking conmen at the Fed now admit they deepened and extended another world war because the League of Nations' utopian ideals didn't work out, as ever. And they followed this up with the U.S. military-industrial complex, which has run rampant ever since, and will continue to until nations are controlled by the people, not the connected few, such as the ESG enforcers and their like. All the while, Switzerland has sailed on rather majestically, keeping its nose out of other people's business and providing an example of why the hybrid system beats our crook-prone representative version and the totalitarian murder machines. Who do you trust more? An MP you have never met and cannot control anyway, or the good sense of your family, friends, and neighbors pooling their knowledge, experience, and care for the long-term future of their families, their country, and its people? This is not a hard choice once you start to think about it. Many years ago, I visited the U.S. military cemetery near Cambridge. I had driven by it many times on my way home, but on this occasion, on the spur of the moment, I turned off the main road and followed the signs to the final resting place of several thousand U.S. airmen. The site was set on a slope that had a superb view across some classic English countryside, with the graves in sweeping ordered ranks facing over a beautiful part of the nation that the young men resting there had come to save, no matter the cost. It was a bright autumn morning, and the car park was almost empty. I got out of the car, appreciated the setting, and turned to pay homage. As soon as I stepped onto the path around the site, I could feel the tears welling up, and I was glad that there were few people around to see me. I thought of those lying all around me and what they had faced so that we would remain free. In my mind's eye, I could see the gunners, the bombardiers, and the pilots as they held their flying fortresses in formation in the bomber stream heading into the flak over their target. I wondered what must have gone through their heads as they were rocked by the blasts from the enemy's guns. But they pressed on. They pressed on for us, for our future, for our freedom. Today, the flak we face comes from controllers using more subtle techniques to herd us, to nudge us along the path they have chosen for us, rather than the future for which those men gave their all. Abuse and intimidation are now the weapons used, and the weapon that counters these is the same as that which those young men so manifestly displayed: courage. The idiots who run things today are much the same as the ones in the past who had thrown out theories that supported their worldview, such as that which suggests that man is a reasoning creature, homo economicus, a rational being that weighs options and takes the logical choice. This fallacy powered the experts in their courses and careers, with arguments back and forth, with econometrics and other fads keeping them occupied and paid handsomely. But those aircrews were risking all because there is no such rational being. The economics professors and the money madmen who studied under them were just reflecting their own beliefs, their cold justification of a system from which they benefited. There are some truths in what they say, but there are falsehoods, hence their faddishness. And the lie is given to the fundamental justification for the endless rule of a few over the many, for the rational explanation of their supremacy by the courage of those young Americans. They were not risking their lives for the poor pay they received. They did so for something much more valuable to them and to us: the right to be free and equal, not richer. What must it have felt like to fly over the target and to pass through the flak unscathed? With the enemy fire receding and every beat of the heart taking them closer to home, hope must have risen. Still, the fighters might tear into them, but eventually they would begin the descent over the welcoming channel, rumble down the runway, and step out onto solid ground, that last mission completed. Maybe a gunner headed off to see that young English girl who he would take back home to America as his bride, there to raise a family in a modest home, leaving the pushy to take their own path, the one the economists and experts seem to think motivates all of us. Either way, there was no such luck for those who rested around me as I looked at their headstones and contemplated the futures that they had sacrificed for ours. I thought of them looking down on us today, and I wondered. At that time, the democratic change I hoped for was largely unstated and unclear. But I knew we had to change if we were to be free. I know that those guys upstairs will cheer us on as we face the arm-twisting, the abuse, and the attacks. Even if we fail, we must honor them and press on to our target. They gave everything they had so that democracy would triumph, that the people would rule, not the few. We must keep the embers hot, ready to burst into life when hope is fanned through the nations once more. We owe all those who have given their lives for our present, gifting us a breathing space by sacrificing their futures so that we could grab this opportunity to create nations in which we all enjoy a democracy that they could only dream of, a real one in which the people truly rule. Then they may rest easy. Then they can rest in peace.